Now we welcome contributor Bill Resnick and his guest Brenna Bell. Brenna Bell is the policy director and attorney for the organization BARC, that for 20 years has dedicated itself to preserving forests, reforesting Oregon, and cleaning its waters, and not just reducing greenhouse gases, but also sucking up CO2, converting it to woody matter. They will discuss legislation for developing strong regulations that are resolutely enforced and making an informed, active movement.
Hi, Brenna Bell. Welcome again to KABU.
Thanks, Bill.
Brenna Bell is the policy director and attorney for the organization BARC, that for 20 years has dedicated itself to preserving forests, also reforesting Oregon, and cleaning its waters, and not just reducing greenhouse gas emissions that come from logging and destroying forests, but also sucking up a lot of the CO2 and converting it into woody matter. Brenna started doing forest protection in 1997. She was arrested many times and involved in many lawsuits as plaintiff and defendant. She realized the movement needs dedicated lawyers. She got a law degree, became a full-time forest protector. Now she does it all, not paid much, I don't think. It's movement work, but still it's a blessing to have fascinating work and to do it with clear conscience and making the good fight. So with BARC, she still goes into the forest for sit-ins and occupations. She lawyers in federal court, she lobbies the legislature and Congress, and she challenges and sometimes negotiated with the Federal Forest Service and even sometimes the state. She also organizes the movement Building Forest Protection Forces, particularly building the organization BARC. So, Brenna, I interviewed you recently about forests and climate change, and you mentioned, but we never got into, how winning a fight with the timber companies or getting some really good legislation or even finding a candidate who wins who's pretty good. But if you do, even if you do all of those things, that does not guarantee that anything will really change. Tell us why.
Well, thank you. First of all, thank you for that fantastic introduction. I sound like I've done a lot of great stuff when you say it that way.
History
I think,
will tell.
You know, Bill, I'd even go farther than saying not all of our victories stick, to saying sometimes winning can make can undercut a victory and make things worse than before. And there are so many reasons that that happens. I think the first one we have to look at is the fact that our legal system and our economic system and, you know, politics as we know it are not set up for us to win and have a meaningful systemic change where moneyed interests are subservient to the interests of the people and the land. That is just not how our system is set up. So sometimes it feels like one step forward, two steps back when we have some kind of victory. And I think that there's a lot of different examples that I could use to illustrate that. One that is really pressing right now is the federal administration's rollback of the National Environmental Policy Act as it relates to forests. So, you know, half of Oregon is managed by the federal government. It's either Bureau of Land Management land, that's most of eastern Oregon and a little bit of southwest Oregon forests, or the entire Cascade Crest, which is managed by the U.S. Forest Service. It's a lot of land in Oregon. So this has a huge impact on our ecosystem. Most of us get our drinking water from federal land. So things that happen on federal lands really impact folk downstream. And there's a law passed in the 70s called the National Environmental Policy Act, which essentially says if the government is going to undertake a major federal action that significantly impacts the environment, they need to study the impacts of it, disclose them to the public, and allow the public to comment and engage in that decision. So it was a way of making transparent the federal government's actions when it was doing something that would adversely impact the environment. And this is the major tool that BARC uses. It's the way that we find out about what the Forest Service is doing, find out the environmental impacts of it, and also we send our volunteers out to the forest to gather information, and then we give it to the Forest Service during, like, the public comment period around any timber sale or pipeline or things like that. So this is a big It's a big law. It is our foot in the door to daylighting what the federal government is doing. So that's NEPA. Here comes the Trump administration, and one of the things they said was, oh, there's so much litigation around the Forest Service not complying with NEPA. There's all these problems with how the Forest Service deals with NEPA. So we got to get rid of it. We got to get rid of this law. That's not what they said in public, but what Trump said is we need to increase the volume of timber coming from national forest lands, and we need to get rid of anything that stands in the way. Clearly, public process is something that stands in the way of getting more commercial product out. So that's Trump. Trump wants more volume to come off of national forest lands and to get rid of anything. And then we go to the law. And yes, there have been a lot of successful lawsuits where we bring claims against the Forest Service for them not complying with NEPA because they don't. They just don't. The law is very clear that there are certain things that they have to do, and then they don't do them. We go to the courts, and sometimes we win, sometimes we don't, which I can get into more about how the courts are stacked against public interest plaintiffs. But so sometimes we win, and the courts say, hey, Forest Service, it's very clear. The law says you need to do this thing. You didn't do it. Go back to the drawing board. And those victories are now being used to completely undermine the public access to NEPA at all, because the Forest Service, through a rulemaking, an executive branch action, has rewritten the rules about what a major federal action is that significantly impacts the environment to exclude maybe 90% of Forest Service projects from here on out from public review and environmental analysis. So because we were successful in actually getting them to follow the law, the Trump administration says, we've got to get rid of this law. We're not going to do it legislatively. We will just rewrite the regulations internally and write the public out of it.
And that happens with almost all laws, right? It's the regulators have a lot of room for either giving it maximum significance in the whole system, or in fact in minimizing it so that it's just a little bit of a pest that they have to jump through hoops in order to evade.
Absolutely. And the rulemaking happens in federal agencies, which are all under the executive branch. So when the administration changes, the agencies change, their directives change, and they can rewrite the rules to minimize the amount of work they have to do. The Trump administration has also taken on the Endangered Species Act through a rulemaking that is basically trying to gut the protections of the Endangered Species Act also for projects on federal land. And so we're in a moment where, you know, these are not the kind of things that movements typically are built around, regulatory actions around agency rules. But when you think of what's at stake, it's the very door into the ability of the public to participate in land management decisions that affect all of us. And without a robust movement and outcry, they can get away with that. And part of the reason they're doing it is because we have been successful at implementing the law, but have not had that people's movement that demands. I mean, that was the thing that created these laws in the first place, was the environmental movement in the late 60s and the early 70s led to this whole suite of sweeping federal environmental laws that have just been eroded bit by bit by bit since then. Because sometimes when there's a popular movement and they have a victory and everyone says, great, we won, let's go take a nap for a couple of years.
Or move into some other kind of movement work, whatever it might be, and lose sight of the long-term effort to save the forest.
Right. And it's every movement. The Civil Rights Movement had the Civil Rights Act of 1964, which was excellent, but that's been eroded over years, and the movement also, you know, to kind of took a break after that. The culture didn't change. The system didn't change. The law changed. And, you know, there's a lot of discussion now about we can't just change the law. We have to change the hearts and the minds of the culture in order to have systemic change. And that's where movements are really engaging and effective.
Yeah. Let me ask you, though, it doesn't often require a change of administration or a change in the legislature, the corporations have lobbyists and money, and they're constantly trying to influence. Well, there's so many ways that they influence the regulators by offering retiring regulators very fancy jobs who have a great deal of influence still in the agency, or
right.
many other ways, or just promising the younger people in the regulatory agencies that they will get a really good job if they do X or Y. That's almost implied in the whole system, actually. They don't even have to say it.
And another thing that's really present in Oregon, more than any other Western state, is the presence of corporate money in politics, and especially timber money. We have a supermajority Democratic government in Oregon, and they will not touch the Oregon Forest Practices Act, which is the most lenient forest protection law, or forest management law on the West Coast. Even Idaho has better environmental regulations for forestry than Oregon does. And that's because the timber industry funds every single Oregon politician, pretty much. I've heard that there's one person who doesn't have timber money. I don't yet know who it is, so I won't say every single one, but the vast majority, both parties in Oregon, have some timber money paying for their campaigns. And what can we do then?
Well,
there's no accountability.
If you have popular movements that are, in fact, challenging and powerful and doing vigilance and really threatening the politicians and the regulators and embarrassing them.
That's the only counterbalance, really, to corporate money is people's movements. And this takes us back to the need for popular movements to hold the government and corporations accountable, and not just accountable, but to change them. Now, I just was at the climate strike with thousands of young people who were so inspiring, and one of the signs that I really liked that I saw there was system change, not climate change, recognizing that we will not solve the impending climate crisis with the same tools that got us into it. We just won't. And as long as we have an economy that is driven by consumption, I think there's another sign that said the growth economy is a lie. It's just like, you cannot indefinitely grow and without killing your host. And the young people are starting to understand that, and that demand that they're not just getting platitudes, that things are going to change at a fundamental level. That, capitalism needs to go, that corporate-driven policies need to go. That was inspiring.
Yeah.
I was so humbled and inspired to see them and see how they were organizing and see the intersectionality of the work that they were doing. I mean, they're just decades ahead of where we were, as young activists.
Right.
And I won't say I have a lot of hope, but I was inspired.
Yeah. Well, in some ways, time is on our side. Time is not on our side, of course, in climate change or forests that they're destroying. They're doing it because it has feedback loops. It could well become an irreversible process.
Absolutely.
And that's a huge problem. But time is on our side in that a lot of these young people will get older. And also, the conditions are going to get worse, and the conditions getting worse is going to be enormously visible, threatening, and frightening when Long Island goes underwater, when food prices begin spiking, when the oceans are filled with plastic, when there's huge droughts and people on the move and wars for water. I mean, there's going to be a Pearl Harbor period when the U.S. and all the industrial countries are going to be forced into asking, how do we save ourselves? And we cannot believe the corporations, although they will keep trying to say we are our saviors. And it seems to me at that point, a democratic left force could prevail in directing and superintending the huge mobilization that will be necessary. At least I look at it that way. But we have to keep building these movements and also building models of what could be done. That's my theory. You get the last word.
Well, I think the main thing when we're talking about building movements and how those are the one thing that protect us from the steady erosion of our civil rights, our environmental rights, I think we need to stop having separate movements and recognizing the intersectionality of all of these issues, that the same forces that oppress people are oppressing the land, the same kind of capitalist colonial settler forces are still doing all they can to exploit everything for their gain. And if we see all of us as part of the resistance in that and united under the banner of climate change, I think that we'll be so much more powerful. And that's been a huge learning point for me. You know, I kind of came up just through doing forest conservation and have realized over time how the mandate to log the forest for corporate gain is the exact same as that which is oppressing people in places everywhere. And we need to all be in this together. And that social movement, I'd like to think, would be unstoppable. And when we start listening specifically to people in frontline communities, the people of color, the indigenous people, the youth, and really take direction from them, and those of us who are older activists, lend our skills but listen to them for direction, that's what gives me a little bit of sense, like, we might not get through this unscathed, but we're going to have a hell of a good time fighting together.
No question about it, although I'm going to steal the last word, Brenna. I'm a little concerned with the strategy. It seems to me that the cities, the population of the earth is now urban and suburban, a vast number of people. We have to change the way our populated areas work.
Yes.
And the people there in the populated areas who are not see themselves now as frontline are going to become frontline.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we have to put a lot of effort into creating models in those cities and changing those cities and changing the consciousness of people in the suburbs and the cities of every race, color, ethnic, and sexual orientation. It seems to me that our efforts, there's a lot that has to be done fighting in the cities themselves. That's where the people live. That's where the riches are. That's where the industries are. It's a strategy that has to involve all of us.
Absolutely.
Against these big predators and the elites who are not going to give up. Brenna Bell, all right, you got the last word.
The last word is we can never rest. We can never rest on our wins. That we just have to keep fighting until the system really, truly changes. And, you know, it's what makes life possible right now, is feeling like we're doing something in defense of that which we love. And luckily, there's lots of opportunities to do that.
And with that, the final thing, we need a good night's sleep often to never rest.
Yes, we do.
How about that?
How about
contradiction?
Just eternal vigilance?
That's not a bad one. Brenna Bell, thanks a lot for talking to us.
Thank you, Bill.
Okay, so long. Give my regards to John.
I will.
Okay.
Okay, bye.